Welcome to episode 5 of The Matchup, a storytelling podcast from St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where you, the listener, gets to decide who told the most compelling story. I'm your host, Jason Franklin, and today it is my pleasure to welcome back, fresh from sabbatical, the Reverend Dr. D. Dixon Kinzer.
Woo!
Hey, Dixon. Look at that energy.
How much energy?
We need to add some more D's in that title.
There is.
Can you become a
little alliteration?
Can you add a DDS at the end? Bless.
And also with us is the Reverend Nick Van Horn, also back for episode 2. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
How you doing?
Can I go by N Mark?
Yes, you can go. You can go. We can put as much stuff.
Weird.
He chose to read the initial, not me.
True.
Yeah.
True.
I'm sure you got a memo.
Wink. Nick, it's your second episode.
Yes.
How are you feeling about it?
Okay. I had a good time last time. We really didn't argue.
Nope.
I mean, it was
a good discussion, actually.
But like I said, I have a plethora of podcast experience under my belt.
That's right.
I have many, many ones of fans.
Ones of fans.
Yes, that have listened. Yes. So,
good.
They're usually just the wives of those who are participating.
Yeah. Well, hopefully they'll subscribe to this podcast too.
Maybe. We might.
Talking to you, Dana.
She does not want to listen to a podcast and hear my voice. So she'll probably skip the ones I'm on.
Dixon, fresh from sabbatical, how does it feel to be back? Do you feel energized? Do you feel ready to go? You got lots of ideas, or you want to go back on sabbatical?
No, I'm energized. I'm ready to be back. And it's like I knew full well coming back to St. Paul's was going to be like stepping in front of the fire hose again. And I stepped.
Good for you.
And I'm loving it.
Good. Good. That's great. So this episode will be coming out in the first week of October. So it's spooky October season for the podcast. We are going to cover today the creepiest story from the Old Testament. Dixon, did you know right away what story you wanted to tell?
This is a good prompt because like creepy can mean a lot of different things, right?
Yep.
It could mean cringy, it could mean scary. And so I tried to really kind of think about all the different categories of Bible stories that would fit the bill. And ultimately I'm very excited about the one I've brought today.
Good. And Nick,
go
ahead. Go ahead.
I'm not as excited. So to add a little context to what we're doing today is Jason had sent this to both Dixon and I, and to kind of use the maybe illustrations of movies, because I'm a big movie fan, and Dixon's seen over 240 of them as well. When you said creepiest or spookiest, we immediately went to like Saw and Suspiria. So Jason had to sit us down and say, listen, priests. And so we had to pull it back. Yeah, I mean, because I totally understand, but at the same time, one of my favorite stories, I'm not gonna be able to share, but this is a good one. I'll give more context why I chose this one before I start, but yeah, it'll be good. It was helpful when you had shared, this is October, it's Halloween season.
Yeah.
So what story would like be a good Halloween-y story to hear, if you will. So that was helpful.
Actually, I am pretty excited about both y'all's picks, and I think it's going to be an interesting episode, and you'll see why.
Yes.
So in each episode, our two guests present their case. We'll talk a little about it, and then after the episode, you listeners get to vote on who told the best story. I'm the only person who knows what story each person is going to tell until now. Dixon, are you ready to present your case for the creepiest story from the Old Testament?
I think I am prepared, Jason.
All right, take it away.
All right, my story is the story of Ehud the judge. And if you're not familiar, let me read it to you. Once again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And because they did this evil, the Lord gave Eglon, king of Moab, power over Israel, getting the Ammonites and Amalekites to join him. Eglon came and attacked Israel, and they took possession of the city of Palms. The Israelites were subject to Eglon, king of Moab, for 18 years. Again, the Israelites cried out to the Lord, and he gave them a deliverer, Ehud, a left-handed man, the son of Gera the Benjamite. The Israelites sent him with tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now, Ehud had made a double-edged sword, about a foot and a half long, which he strapped to his right thigh under his clothing. He presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab, who was a very fat man. After Ehud had presented the tribute, he sent on their way the men who had carried it. At the idols near Gilgal, he came to himself turned back and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. The king said, quiet, and all his attendants left him. So it's just Ehud and the king now. Ehud then approached him while he was sitting alone in the upper room of his summer palace and said, I have a message from God for you. As the king rose from his seat, this is just the Bible. I'm reading the Bible. Ehud reached with his left hand, drew the sword from his right thigh, and plunged it into the king's belly. Even as the handle sank in after the blade which came out his back, Ehud did not pull the sword out, and the fat closed in over it.
Gosh.
Then Ehud went out to the porch. He shut the doors of the upper room behind him and locked them. After he had gone, the servants came and found the doors of the upper room locked. They said, he must be relieving himself in the inner room of the house. They waited to the point of embarrassment. But when he did not open the doors of the room, they took a key and unlocked them. There they saw their lord fallen on the floor dead. And then basically Ehud takes off and escapes, and the rest of the story is him running away.
Wow. That is an interesting story.
So it's just the Bible.
Yes, let's be clear.
But it's one of those ones where it's like, it's so over the top and it's so gross. In fact, this translation actually leaves out a little part where it talks about the king's bowels discharging as the blade is plunged in. So it's like the story is so weird and it's so creepy. And I used to do it like it was a junior high youth group lesson. We would do like gross stories of the Bible for like a month. And this was always the one that they were like, what? But it's actually like, it's one of those stories that you're so, you read it and you're like, this is like Game of Thrones meets Mission Impossible. Yep. Like what is this story? Like, what is the stuff that's interesting about it? And so you go a little deeper into it and it's like, it's in the time of the judges, and the judges, this is basically when like Israel is going from a family to a confederation of tribes. They're on their way to being like a nation with monarchs, but like on the way, they have to figure out how to organize themselves because, well, might can't make right. And like, if we have a disagreement between tribes, who's going to decide who's right and who's wrong? And so the judges become those people. And in this time, it's like over and over again, Israel, it says, keeps doing wrong, doing evil in the eyes of the Lord. And that's important because like, this story is one of like many stories, and it's actually one in the book of Judges of 10 different times that it says, and then again, Israel did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And 10 is that significant number in these sort of design patterns, because it's the number of times that God said, like, it's the number of times there was an "and God said" in the Genesis story, and which is God making the creation. Mm-hmm. It's the number of plagues where God decreates Israel. It's the number of commandments where God recreates or decreates Egypt, recreates Israel. And then this is like, you can basically feel like it's like the car is sputtering. Like God's now working with these people to try to create this new world. And they can't quite get it, right? Over. And so their evil has immediate political consequences, right? They do bad. And then like, there's a Moabite king that's oppressing them, you know? Because it's like, sin is not just like our individual badness. Like the scriptures are always witnessing to. No, it actually has like big scale political consequences for everybody. So you made a noise when it talked about Ehud's left-handedness and the right thigh.
Yep.
Do you know what that's about?
No.
But it's a weird detail, right?
Yes. Yes, it is. It is. And I don't, but I think what's important is for people, and I try to get people to understand this all the time, is when you hear those things, you immediately need to understand that there's a reason why that is in there, you know, to not just gloss over it, right?
Totally.
So, yeah, so please share.
So, same thing. I was like, what is that?
Yeah.
So, basically, he's from the tribe of Benjamin, which means son of my right hand. He's not right-handed, though. He's left-handed, so he's, like, different. And there's even some scholars maintain that this means Ehud had a disability, like his left-handedness was like some sort of physical detriment that...
It is, right? I mean, that's what a left-handed...
I mean, obviously, you know, sorry, honey.
If you're left-handed, please do not send us hate mail.
Sorry, my oldest daughter.
Speaking of wives listening to this, Kristen's left-handed. So I don't know if, you know, that would be an interesting sort of like evolution of some of the ableism that's in like Levitical law and stuff. But what's also unique about it is essentially most people like in the ancient world, like today, were right-handed. And so Ehud makes this sword to go assassinate this king that's oppressing his people and straps it on his right thigh, which if you're right-handed, that wouldn't be where you strapped your knife. It'd be on your left thigh. Mm. So basically his difference makes it so that the guards miss it, right? When he gets searched going in there. And so he shows up and is able to sneak in and liberate his people. Then there's the stuff about the fat and the bowels. And I can't find anybody that had anything to say about here's the meaning of this other than it is a crazy, wild story. Like you could see the like some of the Jewish commentaries were like, you could see the Israeli teenagers thrilling about how like gross the story is and how delightful and stuff.
It's kind of like a perfect campfire story.
It is a totally
when you're at camp and you're listening to it, and you're like, what?
Tell the one about the fat and the guy that discharges his bowels.
It's also very like that story is very like you can see it very well, like the big fat king and the pompousness of him and then the assassin. It's really cool.
So, I mean, it's very vaudeville, you know, which with so much of these ancient Hebrew scriptures, it plays on that. And then the irony kind of continues in the story where it's like, you know, Ehud is the left-handed guy from the right-handed tribe. Similarly, the servants are like, well, the king, he must not be saying anything because he's in there relieving himself. Well, in a manner of speaking, yes, he did relieve himself, but not volitionally. So what's kind of, I think the kind of closing thing with this that I thought was so compelling was that this is one of 10 stories that are like this in the Book of Judges, where like these judges rise up to sort of liberate the people after they've been oppressed for, you know, these sort of generational seasons. And it's, you know, it's 10 of them. Again, that's a quantitative number in Hebrew, or I should say it's a symbolic number. Hebrew numbers are symbolic, not quantitative. So you wouldn't add it up to be like, how many years was this? That would be missing the point of why those numbers are there. But what it does show in those 10 things is the kind of sputter start of the people starting and failing. It's like God has to working with these people. They keep using violence to relieve themselves from someone who's subjugating them with violence, you know? And so you're seeing also a very sophisticated commentary on how pointless the violence is. They're telegraphing to get this done the way God wants to do it. It's not going to be able to be done with violence, which very much is consistent with the witness we see in Jesus when he shows up and he's like, oh, you can't make me king by force. No, it's not how it's going to work. It's not going to come by the sword, you know, that kind of thing. So, and then also the thing that spurs God to move is the cry of the people. The people cried out. And that's also a theme throughout the whole Hebrew Bible is the cry is what motivates God. So that is my creepy Old Testament story.
That is a legit creepy story. I've never heard that story.
I mean, really?
I must have read it, but...
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, I don't...
You did not have a good youth minister then.
As I say.
I mean, yeah. In growing up Baptist, we focused a lot on the New Testament. But then I did EFM, so I read the whole Bible. But I don't remember it. But yeah. That's cool. Thank you, Dixon. Any comments, Nick, about...
I think a good segue is to understand that my story is from Judges as well.
No!
It is. And so Dixon's saying all this context. I'm like, no, keep going, brother. That's fine. It's so fine. But in addition to what Dixon had said, what I love about Judges is this expedited thesis of what the Old Testament is, right? Is these people trying to figure out how to make sense of life and how God fits in it. We must be reminded that God is consistent. We are not. So this journey of how we understand who God is working in this world and the struggle that we have is that we want God to fit in our understanding of who God is. And that's exactly what they do in Judges, right? They're like, they cry out to God, but they still want all of these things too, right? Yeah. The context of my story and a lot of Judges is it's right after, you know, the Moses-Joshua story where they're trying to figure out where they are in this land. And there's a hint of Manifest Destiny-esque in their understanding of who they are in this world, you know. And so they're always constantly fighting with the Canaanites, which is kind of the context of my story and whatnot. But to kind of go back, the reason why I picked this story is, and I thought about that story because I love that story. It's amazing. It's so when Jason said, okay, let's not go full Saw, you just said, okay, I'll just hop over to 7. I mean, it really is the prequel to, you know, I was waiting for Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt to show up at the very end to kind of die. Anyway.
Don't open the box.
Yeah, seriously. but the reason why I picked this story is it's got a little bit of a grotesqueness, but it's kind of comes from the product of those creepy movies of the turn of this past century where it's like this normal movie and then the third act of something happens. You're like, holy crud, right? What's the Primal Fear? You know, it's like a normal court movie, and then this happens at the end, right? Seven has that. Yeah. Fight Club has that. Who is Kaiser Sose, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all these like typical, like you think the story or the movie and the way they produce it is this kind of genre, and then this happens, and that's what kind of makes you think about it for a while, which is why I picked this story. So to give a little bit of context of the story, it starts with the Canaanites and the Israelites fighting, right? And you have the general from the Israelites, which is Barak, and you're going to know this story right away. I want to bury the lead a little bit, right? And then you have the general of the Canaanites, which is Sisera. And so there's this tension between them. The Israelites believe they're supposed to take over the land of the Canaanites and whatnot, and they are getting pummeled, right? The Canaanites have a lot of technology that the Israelites do not have, right? They have iron chariots, Wi-Fi, F-35s, all these things that these Israelites do not have. And Barak is flipping out. So what he does is he goes to their current time judge, which is Deborah. And for those of you who don't know, Deborah traditionally is a female name. So Deborah is a female. That's a big deal in the Old and New Testament for this general to have to go to this woman and say, I need your help, right? So that matters, yeah. Right? So for a story like this to survive that tradition of all that kind of shows the weight to what it is. So he goes to Deborah, and Deborah says, okay, this is where they are. They're the Kishon River. We're going to have you guys go up to Mount Tabor, not the church down the street, but you know the actual mount. And this is what you're going to do. And she kind of plans out how they can do this against this military that they shouldn't be able to defeat. And Barak's response is, and keep in mind, this is a military story. Okay. And Barak's response is, that's fine, that's great, but I need you to hold my hand. I want you to go with me. And she reluctantly says, sure, but if and when we do beat Sisera, the honor will go to a woman. Okay, foreshadowing plot twist. It does, but not who you think, right? And he says, fine, whatever, we just need to do this. So the battle commences. The Israelites actually win this battle, and they destroy everybody from the Canaanite military except for the general Sisera. Sisera escapes. The Israelites celebrate in this, and that's kind of the end of the military story. But then there's kind of like this little extra tagline to the third act, right? Is where you think, okay, the story is almost over. Think of like, remember The Ring, where you're like, oh, they just like, it, you know, everything's fine. Her. And then like the last 15 minutes terrifies you throughout your entire adulthood, yeah. Right? And so it's kind of spoon-fed a little bit. It's a regular judge's story. It's this, you know, back and forth, ebb and flow of this, like Dixon was sharing. And then what happens is you kind of get this like post credit scene, you know, like, you know, and you see Sisera, and he's in the desert, and he finds a tent which is owned by his friend Heber. And he's like, oh, great, I've survived. I found a friend of mine. I can go in this tent and hide there. And his friend says, of course, you are more than welcome to go in my tent. Jael is in there. She will do whatever you need to happen. And so he goes in there. She comforts him. She says, do you want anything to drink? He's like, of course, I'm in the desert. That would be wonderful. She says, take the bed, go lay down. And he says, by the way, if anybody calls for me, I'm not here. Jael goes, gets him some milk to get him to sleep. Apparently milk in the desert is a thing. I can't imagine drinking milk in the desert, but he's tired and thirsty. So he does, and he passes out. And Jael goes and takes a stake from the tent that she has, and she drives it right through his temple. End credits. Credits happen. Wow. That's when the whole audience is like, "What? I thought this was a military movie, right?" So it's a small little thing that happens, and it goes back to the prophecy of, a woman will be honored in killing him, right? Mm. It reminds me of that whole scene in Lord of the Rings where she's like, "I am no man," you know, just a very empowerment thing for this woman to do so. And so she fulfills that prophecy of doing so. And so that's why I kind of picked that story, is the grotesqueness is there, not as much in description as Dixon's, but just the idea of, as you're reading the story for the first time, and this is why I kind of wanted to bury the lead in case you'd never read the story, and you think it's this military story, and then all of a sudden this little thing happens, and you're like, "Oh man, I guess I can't have my kids watch this." Right? and that's the scene that leaves with you when you walk away from the narrative. So that's kind of the spookiness of it that I have, and that's kind of why I picked that one a little bit.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Wow. So, was there any explanation about why she killed him?
I can't remember. I think it was just the fulfilling of the prophecy.
Okay.
And another reason why I love it too is when you look at the feministic critique of the narrative, is implying that the women are the ones who did this, and the weak ones are the men. And for those stories to, like I said, to survive all of that really matter, right? And to show that there's this underlying story of how women are empowered through all this all the time. And so it kind of lays the groundwork for what we see later on in the Old Testament and the New Testament and everything. So those stories really kind of stick with me a lot in that we kind of gloss over them. But like when Dixon talks about the left-handed man, those things matter. Those little things matter, right? And so it also reminds you that God, if God is working in that crazy, weird, grotesque story, it's not in the way that we as human beings expect, right? Through a woman. Through a left-handed person. Mm-hmm. And so there, again, it goes back to what I was saying with, when it comes to Judges in Old Testament, is there's always this rub between what the Israelites want for God, from God to participate, crying out to God. But, and we do it today, which is why I think Judges is so dang prophetic today, is we do represent that. I mean, is when people cry out to God, they're crying out to God, but they're crying out to God to do what they expect God to do, right? Mm. And that's still a theme that we have today. And so that's why I think Judges is such an important story with that. Yeah. So I think about, the men who read this story, and I don't know if they glossed over it throughout history, but for the empowerment of that to happen, for the women to fulfill the prophecy in which the judge Deborah gave.
Yeah.
That's important.
It is.
That makes sense. Yeah.
It's interesting. It's so, okay. Is Judges the creepiest Old Testament book?
It's got a lot of colorful stories in it. Mm. The thing that I'd never thought of before listening to you tell the story was the overlays and analogs with the book of Esther.
Yeah.
Where it's another, like, it's a queen figure as Esther, but it's the story sort of concludes, and then there's this coda that is a weird, like, violent ending. Like, Deborah or Esther's story, we're like, it's Mordecai, and for such a time as this, and they, she saves everybody. But like the last part of the book, she's like, and then they go and kill all their enemies. And it's like, like hundreds of people die, because of her lead. And so I'm interested in like where like the timing of the books all comes from, because like, Judges is one of these histories that kind of is written down later after they've lived this life. And like, did they write it knowing that that kind of pattern was already present in a story like Esther, or did they write the two of them the same? Like, it's an interesting thing to me, but that's not the only time you see that kind of pattern happen, where you're like, there's like this left turn at the end, and it has as much weight as the rest of the story. It's not a throwaway detail. It might be the most important detail of the whole story.
Yeah. It's almost like when if you read a book or watch a film, and there's this one little page or 5 minute thing that's really the whole film.
Yeah.
But you have to watch all of that to get to that in order for the weight of that moment to happen.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's almost like, it's like the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Like, it's like this, like these stories that are all kind of connected, but also independent of themselves and telling this whole, like, in this world that's been created. It's interesting.
That's actually, I haven't thought that through to like lock it down with examples, but the MCU is an interesting overlay with the construction of the biblical canon in regard to, like, there's all these stories that you're telling them in the past, present, and future, also set, 40 or 50 years after these characters existed, and all of those things play into the movie that you end up watching. I'll have to think about that. We should, work on that. That'd be an interesting.
Also, the MCU is a really good example of why to read things narratively and not linearly.
Yeah.
And I make that argument while reading the Bible, is sometimes you don't read it, you definitely don't read it from a historical criticism, the narrative of that and how they all connect back and forth and they're all happening simultaneously is a really good example. Yeah, we could probably do something really cool with that.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, I'm struck by the way that you were mentioning people want to cry out to God then and now, and their expectation for God's activity is that God will behave in the way that they want, expect, believe God to behave. And consistently, God doesn't comport God's self to the social norms of the day. And that would be true of my story too, in some ways. And it's been interesting for me. I don't know if you encountered this researching your stuff, but there were particular traditions of scholarship that really downplayed parts of my story. They left some of it out in this old NIV Bible. I didn't realize that was going to be part of that. I was like, oh, that's not in there.
Well, that's your problem, reading an NIV Bible.
Well, it's an authorized translation in the Episcopal Church.
Yeah. And at Walmart.
And at Walmart.
Sorry.
But there were scholars that would leave some of the details out that, it was like they wanted to sanitize this so they could have, it's instead of reading the Bible on its own terms, they wanted to come to it as more of an apologist for their own tradition. Mm. I think all of us do that to some degree, but it just reminded me of the kind of meta level of still today, we are wanting God to behave in certain ways and be polite in particular ways that align with our current sensibilities and prejudices. And sometimes that comes from just scrubbing little parts of the Bible that just kind of gross, and we don't want to look at them, so we leave them be.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I guess the challenge for everybody listening, all the ones of people that are listening, is when we do cry out to God, what is our motivation for that, right? Is it something because it's something we particularly want, or do we want God to respond because we want God to form the world and history the way we wish? Or, like the entire Bible says, actually, God is doing what God wants to do, and it's never to fulfill our specific needs. And the stories, even though there's that tension, God still provides that, right? At the end of the day, it is provided by God. And I think we need, and that's where the faith, I think, element comes in. But you hear a lot of cheap rhetoric using God in stuff and instilling God into that particular, and we need to take a step back is when we do that and say, God is working in the world in a way that I'm never going to fully understand. And there has to be that humility with it too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if we want to be fair to the actual theological context of that word, the cry, this is the cry that's it's not entirely like a prosperity thing, like health and with God, please just give me, whatever. It's more this it's the cry that goes back to Abel's blood that cried out from the ground to God. Sure. It's the cry of Israel in slavery. It's the cry of the wounded. It's the cry. It's the oppressed cry. It's in Sodom and Gomorrah, the cry goes up. And you see the cry that motivates God is the cry of the marginalized, the suffering, the poor. That affects God and God acts, which is probably why if the systems of this world kind of work for you and you're comfortable, you find yourself a little disoriented sometimes when God does what God does. Cause you're well, hold on a second now. You might be a little threatened kind of some of what, of how things work around here. And God's like, yeah, that's kind of my jam.
Yep. Awesome.
That's a whole other sermon. Totally agree, but that is a whole other sermon.
Thank you y'all for doing this.
Yeah.
Those are great stories.
They were good stories.
Totally fun. Vote for me.
Jesus. You're here. His story was cute. Mine was, I just can't. It's whatever.
All right, y'all, you've heard the creepiest story from the Old Testament. Now the power is in your hands, listeners. In the episode description and notes is a link to a poll. Let us know what you think and let us know who told the most compelling story. We'll continue to have spooky themes throughout this month, so be sure to keep listening. Please like and subscribe if you want to hear more. You can learn more on our webpage, thematchuppodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at thematchuppod. Also, make sure and join our Facebook group, The Matchup Podcast, for extra information about the show. Thanks, everyone, for listening and voting. See you next time.